Penny had the long scripture, so I get the short one. This is Mark chapter 7, verses 14 and 15. Then Jesus called the crowd again and said to them, "Listen to me, all of you, and understand. There's nothing outside a person that by going in can defile, but the things that come out are what defile." Would that every sermon could be that short. But not today. Sunday school starts next week, October 4th. I just found this announcement. Movie club. Oops. But that's what makes being here and life so exciting. It's finding new things as you go, day by day. You don't want it to be a repeat. So go ahead and surprise me. Do something unusual in worship and pretend that it's always done that way. It'll be a joke on John. All right. Let's take a trip down memory lane back to the high school days. How many of us want to do that? Well, we're going to do it today. How many of you have read The Scarlet Letter? Oh, my goodness. Wonderful. It was a requirement, probably, high school. I know it was a requirement for us in Wisconsin. And Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote it. It's the story of Hester Prynne. You all know it, of course, but a young Puritan woman of the late 1600s who took a lover and bore his child while her husband was away on a trip. As punishment for the cruel act of adultery, the colonial magistrates ordered her to embroider a scarlet A on her dress, a scarlet letter. Hester's husband, the physician Dr. Roger Chillingworth, he discovers who her lover is. It's the Reverend Arthur Dimmesdale. So as time goes by, Chillingworth torments the Reverend until at the end of the novel, Dimmesdale bares his chest to reveal to what onlookers insist is a duplicate scarlet letter. Do you remember that, in how that was done? It's quite shocking. I think Demi Moore was in that one. Quite shocking, believe me. Well, shortly thereafter, the Reverend Arthur Dimmesdale, his health deteriorates, his voice decays, he becomes pale, and he eventually dies. And I remember my English teacher explaining the heavy symbolism and allegory set forth by Hawthorne in this transference of sin and guilt, how the awful sin of adultery committed by Hester Prynne and Arthur Dimmesdale destroyed them both. There's an alternative interpretation to the Scarlet Letter, and one that we may not have heard in high school or in college. Jemshed Khan of the University of Missouri claims that such symbolism and allegory are ridiculous. Hawthorne was weaving a murder mystery and not a tale of magic morality. Khan explains that the burning torture on Dimmesdale's chest was a rash of atrophine, a poisonous plant. Chillingworth, Hester's physician husband, knew well the herbs and plants of the day. As a captive of the Indians, the Native Americans, we would say now, Chillingworth had gained much knowledge of the properties of native herbs and roots. So it's written in the Scarlet Letter. Dr. Chillingworth was lacing Dimmesdale's food and drink with poison, and the medicine actually killed Dimmesdale. It was an act of revenge and murder. Dimmesdale died not of sin or guilt. Hawthorne gave away a clue to to the famous murder mystery novel when he remarked, "A man burdened with a secret should especially avoid the intimacy of his physician." The Scarlet Letter, like many classics, includes certain words which through time become blurred and lost in translation. And one of those scarlet words happens to be sin. Today, this word sin has become so distorted and abused, especially by enthusiastic religious Christians, and it's been rendered impotent and non-essential. It has become a joke to those who are liberal Christians or non-theists. And this is because of evangelists like Congregationalist Jonathan Edwards, who went to the extremes of debasing human nature as well as depicting an explicitly violent and sadistic picture of the afterlife. His most famous sermon had this title, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." Consider the medieval seven deadly sins: wrath, greed, sloth, pride, lust, envy, and, of course, gluttony. At some time in any life, most of us, if we'll admit it to ourselves, have confronted several, if not all, of these deadly sins. Each actually is a form of self-idolatry. According to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, these deadly sins are believed to destroy grace and charity within us. An entire self-focus distracts us from community obligations. As Pope Francis said on Thursday before the United States Congress, every single one of us is a mixture of good and bad. We reflect the light while trembling in the dark. One moment we can be the most unselfish, benevolent saints, and the next selfish, greedy sinners. We are mixed blessings, contradictions, and our about-face behavior from one day to the next is part of being human. In the Scarlet Letter is Hester Prynne, Arthur Dimmesdale, or Roger Chillingworth. Who's the sinner? Who's the saint? They're a mixture. The Hebrew word for sin in the First Testament literally means to miss the mark. We find the word in the Genesis myth about Adam and Eve. Through our Sunday school classes, we're taught about how God placed Adam and Eve in the garden, in the paradise, Eden, and gave them permission to eat of the fruit of any tree in the garden except the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So, of course, when it comes to any child with any sort of curiosity as well as any good story, we know one of the characters will disobey God and eat of that forbidden fruit. If that didn't happen, it wouldn't be a story anymore, really. It has to happen. We know it's going to happen. And since God also already knows what will happen, God is God, right? The whole biblical reading is a myth in that it is an explanation of how evil and sin enter into the world. The serpent tempts Eve to eat the fruit. Adam follows Eve, and they're exposed by God. And then God asks Adam who told him to eat the fruit, and he points to Eve. And Eve points to the serpent, and the serpent didn't have a leg to stand on. I just can't resist that one. So, today, we hopefully have a more mature understanding of the nature of sin. Sidney Harris of the Chicago Sun-Times once said that sinning is basically a form of idolatry. It is to make one's goal in life the worship of a false god, not the god of goodness and justice, but the god of ambition, appetite, power, domination, vanity, vindictiveness. Moving a step further from Harris, the psychologist Dr. Carl Menninger spoke of sin in his book, Whatever Happened to Sin, where he related our tendency to regard all misdeeds either as crimes or as a sickness. Instead, he argues that basic sin comes down to a hardening of the heart. As my friend and colleague in ministry, Phil Muth, he put it years ago, sin is aiming for the wrong circles on the target and substituting a lesser goal for the bullseye. It is being separated from God and therefore separated from relationship with other people. So let's talk about original sin. The Bible takes sin dead seriously, and it is not difficult to find passages in both the First and the Second Testaments about sin. The interpreter's Bible goes even further to say there are few chapters in the Bible which do not contain some reference to what sin is or to what sin does. It might even be said that the Bible focuses on only two theological concerns, sin and salvation. Human beings put themselves in sin and suffer its painful effects. God graciously offers salvation from sin, and so in essence, this is what the whole Bible is about. Now, I don't necessarily agree with all of that. I think there's a lot in the Christian Bible, but sometimes people can just kind of wrap it up in a few words. And as an example of this, President Calvin Coolidge was short on word and short on expression. He didn't give a lot of long speeches. He would have made an awful minister. After attending a revival meeting in Washington, Calvin Coolidge's wife asked him about the subject matter of the religious revival, and he answered, sin. To which he continued, what did the preacher say about sin? And Coolidge answered her, he was against it. So while ministers like Jonathan Edwards sermonize on human sinfulness, one can argue that they are simply following in the footsteps of earlier prophets. The ancient prophets, indeed, like Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Amos, Habakkuk, Jesus and Paul challenged and debated those they perceived as sinners. However, in both the Hebrew and the Christian Bibles, those considered to be the greatest sinners are religious authorities and leaders, abusing wealth and fame and power. The poor, the outcast, the orphan, the widow, as well as people with mental and physical disabilities, even those identified as sinners, are the ones defended by the ancient prophets and by Jesus. Those who have title and privilege, the powerful, they're the ones who are missing the mark. Sometimes the ones who consider themselves to be the most religious people in the world ought to reconsider their so-called religiosity, and likewise the ones who consider themselves to be the most non-religious may be, by their actions of goodness in the world, the true promoters of faith, hope, and love in this rather dysfunctional world. There's a Jewish story about a man who brings some very fine material to a tailor and asks him to make a pair of pants. When he comes back a week later, the pants are not ready. When he comes back in another week, the pants are still not ready. 6 weeks pass, 6 weeks, and finally the pants are ready. He tries them on, they fit perfectly. Nonetheless, when it comes time to pay, he just can't resist saying a few things. Well, you know, he says, it took God only 6 days to make the world, and it took you 6 weeks to make just one pair of pants. The tailor says, ah, but look at this perfect pair of pants. and look at the world. The world's not perfect. And this is because I suppose it is inhabited by a lot of imperfect people who are a mixture of goodness and not so goodness. Indeed, both the Jewish and Christian religions are based on a corporate value system. They are community-centered, not self-centered. Those who believe, have this personal salvation belief actually miss the mark and promote hardness of heart. If there is any original sin, it can be found in this self-focus. While Judaism and Christianity challenge its adherents to reflect the blessed image of God implanted in every single soul and therefore the power of one, individuals are likewise reminded of obligations to others and that every single human being has a responsibility to those outside of an immediate circle of family and friends. In that, we become, as Matthew Fox observes, original blessings to each other. I'm going to conclude with a few words from a speech just shared, and I mentioned this earlier. Pope Francis, you know, has been in town, and he shared some words with Congress this past Thursday, and I found a few words of his that fit beautifully into the sermon. And so, in conclusion, here's the Pope. All of us are quite aware of and deeply worried by the disturbing social and political situation of the world today. Our world is increasingly a place of violent conflict, hatred, and brutal atrocities committed even in the name of God, even in the name of religion. We know that no religion is immune from forms of individual delusion or ideological extremism. This means that we must be especially attentive to every type of fundamentalism, whether religious or of any other kind. A delicate balance is required to combat violence perpetrated in the name of religion, an ideology, or an economic system, while also safeguarding religious freedom, intellectual freedom, and individual freedoms. But there is another temptation which we must especially guard against: the simplistic reductionism which sees only good or evil, or if you will, only the righteous or only the sinners. The contemporary world, with its open wounds, which affects so many of our brothers and sisters, demands that we confront every form of polarization which would divide it into these two camps. We know that in the attempt to be freed of the enemy without, we can be tempted to feed the enemy within, to imitate the hatred and violence of tyrants and murderers is the best way to take their place. Our response must instead be one of hope and healing, of peace and justice. We are asked to summon the courage and the intelligence to resolve today's many geopolitical and economic crises. Even in the developed world, the effects of unjust structures and actions are all too apparent. Our efforts must aim at restoring hope, righting wrongs, maintaining commitments, and thus promoting the well-being of individuals and peoples. We must move forward together as one in a renewed spirit of fraternity and solidarity, respecting our differences and convictions of conscience, resolving to support one another, cooperating generously for the common good. Amen.